Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley at the Times and Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival, having a lovely time. Coming up on today's episode, you'll be able to hear a debate that I did with Tom McTague, Aisha Hazarika and Peter Cardwell, all about personality in politics. Who's got it, who hasn't, and does it matter? It's a special live debate here at the festival. As an extra bonus as well, you'll be able to hear from Giles Brandreth. I bumped into him, obviously former Tory MP, jumper wearer, bear collector, all-round lovely man. So you'll hear from him in just a moment. But first, our columnist panel. And today, joining me in the Times Radio studio tent was David Sanderson, arts correspondent for the Times, and Manveen Rana, presenter of the Stories of Our Times podcast, one of our sister podcasts at the time. So there we are, David and Manveen. You've been here since the very beginning, David.
I have, since Friday, yeah, goodness, yeah. So we're more than halfway through it, but it's been a feast for the mind.
What's been the best thing, best person, event that you've been to?
Well, the most stimulating was probably Susie Dent, actually, the doyen of Countdown's Dictionary Corner, who was just fascinating. Like yourself, she has great comic timing, but perhaps unlike yourself, she has a great...
She knows things.
She knows things, so she is a fantastic lexicographer. And she mounted this argument about the positivity and the negativity of the English language, and you have all these negative words like reckless, feckless, discombobulated, but you also have the positive counter of those. So you can be combulated and you can be reckful, feckful, etc., etc. So she said that it probably does say something about the national psyche that we concentrate on the negatives rather than the positives.
Are you now trying to smuggle some of those words into copy? Have you managed to get anything in the paper yet?
I've got two words that have never appeared in the Times before in an intro, which I'm very proud of.
Which were what were they?
They were reckful and they were... I forgot.
It was a good one, though.
Yeah, it was a very good one. What about you, Manveen? You've been chairing lots of events.
I've been chairing events, which is always fun. So I did John Barnes on Monday night.
Very good.
I'm doing a panel on Northern Ireland coming up later today, and then something on identity in the internet age.
That's a mixed bag.
Generalist.
Yeah, exactly.
I think they just throw me at whatever's there.
Yeah. Like Manveen could pretend to be interested in that.
Pretend? Been fascinated by everything I've done so far.
That is true. That is very true. Now, David, you were at Jimmy Page last night.
Yes.
And the
yes.
one thing that everyone is talking about this morning
is the fact that he went for a toilet break halfway through.
He just got up and walked off.
He did say, I hope you don't mind if I leave for a minute. And Will Hodgkinson, who was interviewing him, said, of course, of course. And then at least Jimmy Page had the wherewithal to say to the sound people, you might want to turn the microphone off. So he did disappear for 5 minutes, which I covered book festivals for 8 years, and that has never happened before. It was an extraordinary moment. We're assuming that he went to the toilet, but for
yes,
a pee. But given his history...
No, I like to make clear that's David's insinuation and not mine or the views of Times Radio. How has it been, David? Because you've been to these so many times, the first post-COVID one.
Yes.
People just seem to be really enjoying it. There's a few masks, but not very many.
No, there's not. There seems to be a sense of liberation, and there's obviously great enthusiasm for being here and being in the room in person, which is just great, you know, to actually see people rather than on a screen. The only Jonathan Franzen, I think, is the only person that I've seen on a screen. And there was that divorce between the audience and the speaker. But everything else has been fantastic. You know, everybody's been really enthusiastic.
So nice to have a live audience, because last year they had one, but it was socially distanced. So you'd walk in and there'd sort of just be islands of people here and there.
Yeah,
great for atmosphere.
Yes.
It was very dispiriting, actually. But credit to them for putting something on.
But those small groups of people is almost worse than no audience.
I know. Because then you can pretend there's a cheer. And instead you just sort of have people, like, you know, isolated clapping.
No, the one that we did yesterday, having just the roar of a crowd was terrific. It was so like you.
I mean, Matt, you get that everywhere.
Well, that is true.
He walks into the office, roar.
I just carry around my own sound effects box, so I get a round of applause wherever I go.
The joys of working in radio.
Do you ever, when you've been doing these things, and you're just like sort of throwing, man, for me, going to do this, going to that. Do you ever get starstruck? Who's the biggest person that you've
starstruck? No, but that's only because I started life actually covering literary festivals like this as a diarist. So I was straight out of university and you just chucked into a room and you always had to go up to the most famous person there and start chatting. So, like, very quickly, you just got quite used to it.
What's your best... You've probably both done this. Your best opening gambit to strike up a conversation with a celebrity who doesn't really want to speak to you?
God, I've used all sorts. I mean, once I had to talk about wallpaper with Madonna.
Hang on a minute. This is... What?
Well, you have to find
here.
A way of getting... No, that was at a fashion party a long time ago.
And where does she stand on wallpaper?
Well, she seemed fascinated by the wallpaper in there, but I think it's because she was avoiding seeing or talking to anyone.
She was just looking at the wall. And that was everything they had to go with.
So it was the only thing you could really... you could go in on.
David?
I don't have anything that can compare to that. I can tell you about William Morris's wallpapers, but that's about
there
it.
There was an event. There was an event.
There was.
Cheltenham.
Yeah,
something for everyone.
You do get everything. You can go from Matt Charlie to William Morris wallpaper. But what is fascinating is that this curator of the William Morris Gallery did have a serious point to make about period dramas, Victorian dramas, and how in the background there is inevitably some William Morris wallpaper. But at this time, then, he was very much somebody that was providing wallpaper for the avant-garde. You know, there's very few people that did have it up. But now, because it is readily available, then it becomes a cheap, easy solution.
And it's all the rage.
Perhaps not cheap.
Yeah.
That's sort of, you know, Boris Johnson-style refurnishing now, isn't it? Very William Morris, very sort of...
That's it. You talk about wallpaper with Madonna, and I end up talking about Carrie Johnson's wallpaper.
We do seem to keep coming back to it.
And this is nice. The Times Radio wallpaper we've got behind us as well. Should we talk about space? I'm interested in this Prince William. Isn't happy about people going into space.
Yeah. He's very much taken a leaf out of his dad's book, it seems. And if you see his full... if you hear the full interview, then it is fascinating. He says that his dad did have a very hard time when he was raising these environmental issues, you know, however many years ago. But it's also, I would argue that this is Prince William striding quite forcefully into the political arena.
Yeah.
And it'd be fascinating to see how that plays out.
You're saying that entrepreneurs should focus on saving Earth rather than engaging in space tourism? Because, you know, whether it's William Shatner or Jeff Bezos or whatever it is.
I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? At a time where we're all sort of supposed to be much more conscious about not taking unnecessary flights and taking one off the planet
but
seems
it's
a little excessive.
Not just clearly there is an emissions issue, but also, like, as we've seen during the past 18 months of the pandemic, when the world throws everything at a problem, we can get a vaccine much more quickly and all that sort of stuff. And in fact, if they just took all of that focus and attention and effort and technology and all of that that's putting William Shatner into space and maybe diverted it towards carbon capture and storage or, you know,
that is sort of a worrying thing, though, isn't it? You suddenly have all these individuals with their own tastes who have more money than a lot of nations.
Yeah.
You know, while a lot of countries are having to cancel their space projects or aren't being able to sort of send up, you know, the satellites they want to, it's really bizarre to see. You know, just because Jeff Bezos wants to go and do a particular thing, it's not necessarily linked to what science wants to be investigating in space.
Yeah.
It's not sort of being focused by where science wants to be. And it's not just, I mean, if you look at sort of Silicon Valley, they're doing this everywhere.
Yeah.
They're suddenly obsessed with anti-aging stuff and living forever. But, you know, this isn't how a
That's
country would sort of choose
not, yeah, exactly. yeah, yeah,
to
yeah.
invest. And, you know, it's hard to tell whether this is really where science wants to be either. A lot of this stuff is sort of slightly on the edges of credibility.
And it's always the men, isn't it?
It's always the men.
And there was it Jeff Bezos's rockets? It was particularly phallic.
Yeah. It's basically the billionaire equivalent of a Lamborghini, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. It's a midlife crisis.
It's a midlife crisis.
Yeah. And it's they all get divorced and then buy a rocket.
But then you see what Jeff Bezos' wife is doing, and that she's given all of her yeah. wealth away to good causes.
Again, you're right, it goes down to the gender division.
Indeed. Although, Bill Gates, you know, actually unusually in that world, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
He did while it was the Bill and Melinda Gates. It'll be interesting to see what he does
post-divorce.
Yeah. By all accounts, all the stuff coming out so far doesn't make it sound like he was...
Yeah, maybe he's going to walk away from that and he's going to go and get a rocket himself.
Go back to the partying we keep hearing about now.
A little paperclip will pop up and say, I think you're trying to go into space. we've talked quite a lot about this, about Sally Rooney this week, just because obviously it's Cheltenham, that's what people have been talking about, and her say she doesn't want her book translated into Hebrew. But there's a really interesting piece by James Marriott in the paper today that you want to talk about, Manvi. What's he written?
Well, we both read it, and it's a brilliant column, because he sort of talks about how difficult it is for novelists in Britain and America to be taken seriously the moment they start talking about their views, effectively. You know, nobody wants to hear it, whereas in France, you know, you're instantly a public intellectual, and they take everything you say as sort of some great pearl of wisdom. You know, here we keep seeing it with Hilary Mantel and people, and everyone just sort of, there's a collective national rolling of the eyes. It's just like, make it stop.
Just write your books.
Yeah, whereas in France, I mean, you know, I'm not sure it's always a good thing, but you know, you do have people like Bernard-Henri Lévy, you know, a man who's famous for saying, God is dead, but my hair is perfect, effectively marching the country into war in Libya. And then recently, you know, when Afghanistan was falling apart, he rocks up in Panjshir to talk to the rebels, and you think, God, haven't they suffered enough? But you know, there is sort of a danger with the French system that actually people who are just very fond of expressing their opinions do get taken very seriously.
I mean, what is next? Is Sally Rooney going to be cancelled because of this? It just seems like she's...
She has been.
Well, she's chosen her battlefield, and regardless of what you think of it, you know, it is her right to choose it. And there's a lot of attention given to it. And James makes the point that there are many, William Dalrymple and Jarvis Cocker, are also boycotting Israeli products as a result of the dispute with the treatment of the Palestinians. So I do find it very unfair. You know, it's not really a surprise that she would have these feelings. And, you know, she's... OK, there are questions about whether there is a whiff of hypocrisy, you know, and the fact that her book is available in Saudi Arabia and China, and questions can be asked about that.
Well, I there's a lot of that that's been in the papers in the last couple of days. I sort of think it's slightly unfair, though, because I don't know if she sort of decided she wasn't going to sell her books in China, I'm not sure the Chinese nation would sort of stop this and take stock. Yes. Whereas in Israel, because they've had an arts boycott for so long, it will get headlines, it will get noticed.
Yeah,
also, with both China and Saudi Arabia, you know, the idea of a boycott is to sort of be a thorn in the side of the government. And, you know, China has been a closed society for so long. Yeah. They haven't always welcomed ideas or literature from the West. So actually, just by publishing there, you're being the thorn in the side of the Chinese government.
Well, we were talking about this with Tim Marshall yesterday, and he said that China wanted to publish his book and then went through and listed all the bits they wanted to take out of it first.
Yeah.
No, that's not publishing my book. But actually, I suppose the point about authors having views, that's basically why you're here, isn't it, David? So
yes,
you go to the talk where someone's plugging a book, and then you hope that they stray into areas of controversy.
They will never trouble the pages of the Times unless they do have views.
Yes, so,
yes exactly. You do want them to be outspoken, entertaining, and of course informative. But yeah, I do, you know, I worry about where we're going if Sally Rooney is getting such a hard time for taking, you know, a principled decision, a decision that she thinks is principled.
Who's been the most newsy person this week?
It was very hard to gauge. I mean, okay, so if you judge it by the prominence within the paper, then it will be an author talking about Agatha Christie's CSI skills. In fact, it is fascinating. Agatha Christie used the word scene of crime and used a crime kit long before these were ever used by the police, which, and this is in what, 19, her first novel, which was written in 1916, had scene of crime, and then Poirot, in her second novel, had a crime kit. And of course, it was 1920s, 30s before these things became readily available.
To be fair, so did Conan Doyle, though. It was all about sort of checking the scene of the crime and finding little bits of snuff.
Yes, but I don't think he actually used that phrase, scene of crime, which is now ever present in any police investigation. So, I mean, Agatha Christie is an author that just keeps on giving. You know, there's been so many reassessments of her oeuvre, you know, and her sort of, you know, she's regarded as quite cosy, but actually, if you read her books, they can be pretty, pretty dark.
And political.
Yes.
Weirdly political.
Yeah, totally.
But she's managed to avoid being cancelled.
She has so far.
Despite some of them.
The festival isn't over.
There was a
We've got till Sunday.
On the subject, because obviously Agatha Christie is always a sort of, you know, blockbuster, there was a brilliant piece in Rose Wild's column in Feedback talking about the sort of books that, you know, the topics which always do vote. Obviously Second World War books and, you know, people love all that. And she went back, I hadn't realised this, Alan Corran, obviously famously a columnist of the Times as well, asked W.H. Smith what subjects back in the 1970s were guaranteed to sell books. And they said pets, golf and Nazis.
So together.
And so he produced a collection of essays which he called Golfing for Cats, which had a cover with a cat on the front playing golf in front of a large swastika. And there was no mention of any of that in the book. That was just what he put on the front.
Such an alarming view of the British nation.
But apparently in America, the big thing that they're obsessed with is former presidents, health things and pets. And so someone published a book called Lincoln's Doctor's Dog, which is all about a dog that belonged to Abraham
Three
Lincoln's
ticks.
Doctor. Yeah, ding, 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 ding. That's all you need to do. That's the secret.
Really depressingly, though, I mean, they often found this with sort of like war reporting, you know, because so much of it becomes, you know, you get sort of slightly immune to sort of seeing shocking images.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only time people would really stop and listen is when you sort of report about animals in a war zone.
Yeah. Well, as we saw with Matey and his cats and dogs in Afghanistan.
Prime example.
Manvi Rama there. And of course, you can download, subscribe to the Stories of Our Times podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. And David Sanderson there, covering all the goings on at the Cheltenham Literature Festival, which you can read in the Times. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Now, one of the great things about being at the festival is who you can bump into. And I was just ambling about the place. And who should I find? It's only Giles Brandreth.
Excited to be bumping into you because yours is one of my favourite shows on Times Radio. And I thought I'd been a guest of yours many times.
No, we've tried without success.
Clearly, I'm having sort of fantasy moments of thinking, you know, I'm on Times Radio with Matt Chorley. Well, I'm not. I'm just wake. But I do wake at about 5 a.m. most mornings worrying about something. And it's probably worrying that I haven't actually turned up in your studio before.
Now, the reason we're here is because you're here in Cheltenham promoting sounds cheap, promoting, merely drawing people's attention to your memoir, Odd Boy Out.
Yes, and you're right to say plugging. That's, in a sense, what it's all about. And it's not an unworthy thing to do. It all began, in a way, the big plugger of his own work was the great Charles Dickens. And I'm very excited because towards Christmas I do a podcast with Susie Dent, the lexicographer from Countdown, and we do a podcast every week called Something Rhymes with Purple, all about words and language. And we've been asked to do a live one at Birmingham Town Hall. And I said to Susie, we must do it. She said, why? I said, well, because we like doing them. But she said, why Birmingham Town Hall? I said, because I happen to know that both Oscar Wilde and Charles Dickens went there to give talks. And, of course, they sold their books. So this is a tradition that goes back a long way. Was it Dr. Johnson who said, no one but a blockhead wrote except for money? The truth is, people say to me, Charles, why are you working at your age? And I explain, I need the money. I mean, I do need the money. My wife and I, we have 3 children, 7 grandchildren. We've discovered over the years that money is the one thing keeping us in touch with them. So if you're going to write a book, you want to spread the word. And in this instance, actually, it's an autobiography. So you feel I've felt more personally invested in this book than probably any book I've ever done before. And both the writing of the book and now the talking about the book have been slightly strange experiences for me and not like what I'm used to. I mean, I am used to talking, I'm used to writing. I've written biographies of other people, most recently a biography of the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip. In fact, a version of it was published earlier this year called Philip, the Final Portrait, which attempted to be a final portrait of a remarkable man. But getting to know him while I was writing this book, I realised that he was somebody who was very much against introspection, telling your own story. And he was used to say, don't talk about yourself, talk about other people. No one's interested in you. And he came from that generation where he believed you should look up and out, not look down and in. So I was very conscious of that when I was writing this book. And I only wrote it because lockdown came along and I needed to do something, because I've always felt you should be busy in life. And my tour that I was going to do of my stage show, Break a Leg, was postponed. And I was in the house. I couldn't go out and research anything. And I thought, well, the one thing I have got in this house is my own life, my own story, because I keep everything. From 1959 onwards, I've been keeping a diary. And also all the papers that go with it. I mean, railway tickets, menus, school books, everything. Postcards, love letters. Ones I've received. Ones I've sent, it turns out, no one has kept. No. I met a couple of old girlfriends and said, have you gotten them? And they said, no, good God, no, Charles. We threw them away at the time. And my wife then said to me, Charles, you must understand, if you're going to write about your early girlfriends, that no girl will have kissed you except to shut you up.
Now, the thing I'm interested in is you have a reputation for being funny and entertaining and knowing a good, jolly anecdote. But did you find, because life isn't all fun and entertaining, did you find this a difficult process, looking back over the highs and lows of whatever happens in life? Are there bits of Giles Bradworth being sad, reflective, regretful?
If you're sitting there listening to this, thinking, well, actually, I've been meaning to write a memoir of our family, not necessarily for publication, but for the children or grandchildren, think carefully. I found it a much more disturbing and at times painful process than I thought it was going to be.
What in particular?
Well, my wife said to me, if you're going to do this, if you insist on doing this, actually try and go a bit deeper. Don't just fall back on the old name-dropping. That irritates people after a while. And, don't fall back on the teddy bears and the woolly jumpers and the love of words. Actually try and work out who you are and why you are who you are. And so that's what I tried to do. And in doing it, I found, in my case, and I think it will be interesting to the reader, because I hope when people read the book, they'll think, actually, who am I? What made me? Is it my forebears? Is it my family? Is it my school teachers? School teachers influence a lot. Or is it later in life, who I married, my work? In my case, I think I was fully formed. I am what my childhood made me. What my forebears made me is quite significant. And my parents, in particular, obviously, I'm not an only child, but I might as well have been an only child, because I had three older sisters born just before the Second World War. I was born a few years after. So I'm like an only child, and I was the first boy. So I was the golden boy. In fact, my father wanted to call, if I'd been a girl, I was going to be called Mercedes, because that's what he really wanted. So there is this golden child born. And I just took it for granted that I was a golden child and I was much loved and that I could do anything, because my parents encouraged me to believe that. But as I began to write this book, I began to discover who I was and then also, more importantly, who my parents were. And I learnt through writing this book the sacrifices they made to give me the life I have had. And the book is called Odd Boy Out, because my publishers thought I was a bit of an oddity. And they had a nice picture of me as a little boy at the Tower of London in between a beefeater and a Coldstream Guardsman. They thought, oh boy, that's a nice title. I wanted to call it I Hope There Is a Heaven. Because as I was writing this, I kept thinking, oh, I hope there is a heaven. I'd love my parents to be able to read this, my father in particular, because I'm middle class and had a middle class upbringing. My father was a solicitor. But I don't think I realised till I was writing this book how much they sacrificed to send the children to private schools. They didn't have to, but they thought it was the right thing to do. My father spent essentially more money than he earned every year of his life, and eventually it caught up with him. And when he died aged 71, because he'd run out of rope, but also because because when he was a boy, 17, he'd been to a fortune teller who'd looked at his line of life and said, "Oh, look, 17, you can live at least 70 years and 10. 70 plus one, 71. And my father used to talk about that. And when he got to 71, within a week, he was dead. Wow. So it's a book about parents. It's a book about teachers. For people of my generation, it's a trip down memory lane because it's about the 1950s, 1960s. For people like you, Matt, and the younger generation, it's history.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite interesting because it's British history. And it's quite domestic. It's about what I watched on TV.
Yeah.
It's about family life. It's about middle class hardship, which is a subject I think that isn't actually much tackled.
Everyone spends slightly more than they have, and I think that's a middle class. But you know, nobody, unless you're a gazillionaire, yeah, nobody thinks they've got enough money, and you're always trying to slight. You know, you buy that car that you probably can't afford, or you move the house and all that. One thing I do want to ask you about, because we do politics on my show normally, is of course you were Conservative MP, you were a whip.
Was.
Do you reveal the dark secrets of the whip's office in your book?
No. That you have to read another book of mine called Breaking the Code, which is still in print, published by Bitebag. And that is an account, a diary, because I keep a diary, of my time in the whip's office. Though there are a lot of politicians in this book, and you'll discover, if you read the book, how I've shaken hands with every prime minister, I was going to say since Harold Macmillan, but if you read the book, you'll discover how I managed to shake Winston Churchill's hand as well.
Wow.
So there's politics in it, but it's not a political book. It's really, it's a book about growing up and what makes us the people that we are. I hope it will make people, in fact, I know people have kindly said it does make them laugh at times, in a good way. And it does also, I think you shed a few tears. I certainly did when writing it. When discovering things about myself and about my family, and one of my sisters who had a lot of mental challenges, and I think my mother, though I didn't realize at the time, suffered from bouts of depression. I never understood why she was, you know, in bed all day long. But that obviously, in retrospect, I know. I see all that. And it's quite interesting to think about your parents. And in some ways, it's heartbreaking to think about your parents after they've gone. And in a way, that's why I hope there's a heaven, because I would love to be able to say thank you to them. So I hope there is a heaven, and that God, the ultimate librarian, I hope that she has subscribed to Penguin Books and found herself a copy of Odd Boy Out for the heavenly shelves.
What a lovely message to have got out of... because so many celebrity memoirs, I was sort of, a funny thing happened to me in the toothbrush factory, and then that's the end of it. I'm interested in, having now done that, it was a lockdown project, it's your whole life in a book, what's the next chapter for Giles Brandreth? Is there a thing that you'd like on your CV or in the extra chapter in the back of the book?
I like doing new things. I like doing different things. I knew the psychiatrist, Dr. Anthony Clare, and he once said to me, "Don't be frightened of change, Charles. I think you're frightened of change." And I'm quite conventional. And he said, "Change is the salt in the soup of life. People say don't rock the boat, but actually a little gentle rocking does you good." So I tried to test myself to go out of my comfort zone. And I tried that with the book. Because, as you rightly say, I mean, I've done the Oxford Book of Theatrical Anecdotes. Mm. I've written a biography of somebody like the Duke of Edinburgh, where the story... it's a colossal story. But this, personal, intimate, private, and to do that, to laugh and to cry. I'm somebody who sees the glass half full, always. But it doesn't mean to say I don't realise the other half must be empty.
Just finally, just because you do have a reputation for not so much name dropping, but just having a great... I don't know how you remember all these things, and whether it's poems or anecdotes or something. Give me your best, your current best big name celebrity anecdote.
Well, I met Matt Chorley. Exactly. Well, I thought the viewers would enjoy that. I'll tell you my favourite poem at the moment.
Perfect.
And I went to a funeral the other day. We haven't been to funerals for a while, but I went one. It was an old friend, a good friend, and he was of an age. And at this funeral, somebody recited these four lines. "From quiet homes and first beginning out to the undiscovered ends, there's nothing worth the wear of winning but laughter and the love of friends." So that's what we want in life. Laughter and the love of friends.
100, but I couldn't agree with you more. Giles Manners, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much for joining us on Times Radio.
Yeah, and I'll tell you about that encounter with Putin on another time. but he's a smooth operator, I can just tell you that much.
Giles Bandrith there. Right, up next, you'll be able to hear our debate on personality in politics.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast now. It's time for this.
I like to paint. I make things.
You are the weakest link. Goodbye.
No, I don't find it nauseating. I find it very refreshing.
I have a thing where I make models of... When I was Mayor of London, we build a beautiful... I make buses.
There's only one person I can remember around here knifing a foreign secretary, and I think I'm looking at him.
I turn it into a bus, and I put passengers...
You know, OK, that's what you do to enjoy yourself.
I paint the passengers enjoying themselves...
OK, great.
..on the wonderful bus.
Great.
Yeah, how much does personality matter in politics? Does it matter? Should it matter? Who has it and who doesn't? And can they learn it? That's what we discussed in a brilliant panel discussion at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. I was joined by Peter Cardwell, a former special advisor to several cabinet ministers, Tom McTague from The Atlantic, and Times Radio's very own Aisha Hazarika. So let's take a listen. Starting with Peter, I asked how big a factor personality actually is in politics today.
I think it's less a personality and probably more a persona, because obviously in politics there are people who have they have the public-facing role and the private-facing role. We respond to that in some way, but is it really true? And it's very difficult to know that. And of course, that's the thing, of course, people always said about Gordon Brown, that he was someone that in public came across as very, very serious and very kind of academic in a way and failed to connect. Yet when you met him personally, when he was Prime Minister before or even afterwards, he was someone who was very engaging. John Major as well, the grey man of politics, who has an amazing personality. And also, I think one thing I'm sure you want to talk about, Matt, is in terms of when politicians are in office and what they feel they can be. I mean, Ed Balls, of course, in office was someone who a lot of people didn't really respond to particularly well, thought he was maybe a bit boorish, maybe a bit serious. And then, of course, he went and Strictly Come Dancing and everybody realised, you know, he had a great personality. And actually, I remember Yvette Cooper giving a talk one time after Theresa May had famously done her dancing taken the hand out of herself. And she said, she was echoing the words of the vice presidential debate in 1988 when she said, Theresa May thinks she can go from hated politician to national treasure simply by dancing on television. Theresa, let me tell you something. I know Ed Balls. I married Ed Balls. Theresa, you're no Ed Balls.
I'll come to you in a second, Tom. But Aisha, from your perspective, having worked with politicians, does all that ring true from what Peter was saying, that there's the sort of the real person and then there's the sort of public-facing personality?
Yeah, I mean, often when you're preparing politicians for their sort of media things, the most difficult things to prepare for are the sort of personality interviews where somebody wants to do sort of a more in-depth background piece. So you can go through all the policies and brief what the policy is. Then you get to the tortured bit, which is like, and now to you, Minister, as a person. And the problem is that a lot of like everyone has a personality. It's not that politicians don't have a personality. But often the
I can think of a few.
No, but the worst thing is the personality they have is so unappealing. You're like, let's not share that with the public. Let's like make up a different persona. And I think one of the things that is really, really hard is that like if your boss is somebody who has basically been a career politician and they've wanted to be a top flight politician since they were kind of yay high, they are quite boring, or the bits of their personalities are psychopathic, you know what I mean, in terms of like how have they... So it's very hard to like fake a hinterland. So like when Alice Thompson and Rachel Sylvester do these interviews, they do these quick fire rounds at the end where they're like Strictly or Bake Off, and sometimes as some politicians, they don't even know what those things are. Like you're like, it's... There was this great episode, I think it was The Thick of It, and it was this thing called the Zeitgeist Tapes, where they had to sort of kind of try and educate politicians about sort of normal popular culture things. And there is a lot of that that goes on in politics. But I think one of the things that is hard, and Peter sort of alluded to it, and you mentioned Ed Miliband, when you are in the public eye, it is very difficult to keep your confidence up, because everybody is just scrutinising every single inch of you, you know, how you look, your hair, how you eat a bacon sandwich, like everything, basically. Yeah. And suddenly, you're meant to go out and be this big kind of personality, but actually you're quite diminished inside because, you know, you're so paranoid and so insecure about yourself. So I think that's why Boris Johnson is quite a remarkable character, because he does seem to, like, just genuinely not care.
Tom, to what extent, you and I have worked together reporting on a lot of the people we're talking about, it seems like there's like just enough person. We don't want a very boring person, because they're of no use to us, you know, writing about the showbiz for ugly people that is politics. But you don't want too much, but actually for a long time, Boris Johnson's probably a bit too much personality. Critics of Jess Phillips would say, steady on. I mean, we like a bit of straight speech, but that's a bit too much personality. Is there a sweet spot of just enough political personality?
I don't know, because some of those characters that you can think of, I don't know, somebody like David Cameron, you know, they might have hit that sweet spot, and then and look what happened, you know, complete disaster. I don't know. I remember speaking to a special advisor who worked for Cameron, and he said the absolute killer when you're working for a politician is that, or for a leader, is for them to go into a room and not want to be the centre of attention. If they're kind of shying away, it's just a killer, and you can't do anything with it. You need the person you're representing to want to be there, to want to lead, to want to be the most interesting person in the room. And obviously with Boris Johnson, you have that. Although I think he's such a fascinating character, because he is also can be quite depressive and kind of loner, you know, he can just go into himself and disappear. And some people who have seen him say he can do this in a room if he is not the main attraction, or if the conversation is veered off to somebody else, he kind of sulks. And that's just an amazing sort of insight into the man. Kissinger talks about leaders only get decisions that are kind of 51-49 decisions. Easy decisions that are, you know, 80-20, 70-30, they happen way down the chain. Somebody else has made those decisions. They don't arrive at the Prime Minister or the President's desk. So you're getting these 51-49 decisions. And the job of a leader is to make the decision before they've had all of the information and the facts. They have to make it early. And how do they do that? They rely on their instincts and their character.
Let's talk about Blair and Brown, because I think I don't know if many of you have seen this the BBC series, which is absolutely fascinating, all about the whole sort of period of New Labour. But actually, in Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, you have the exact thing that we are talking about. One of them, and I don't know whether it's personality or stardust or charisma or whatever you call it, one of them had it, one of them didn't. You know, in so many ways, they were the same. They were elected at the same time. They went on the same political journey. and yet one of them had something that the other one didn't. Do you think that's fair, Aisha?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the tragedy about the whole Blair and Brown thing was that they were like this kind of perfect unit. They were the total kind of yin and yang. They were like this amazing double act. And Tony still does just have it, whatever it is. You know, you could be in a room and have your back to the door, but you would just feel that Tony had arrived in the room. There was a sort of crackle in the air and you could smell the fake tan. No. It's like... it's live. No.
I think the tan's probably real.
But then I think the same is true of... actually, when I interviewed George Osborne for my book about Prime Minister's Questions, he made this point about him and David Cameron, that David Cameron had this kind of effortless sort of public persona and was very, very skilled at the dispatch box and was very comfortable being a performer. And George Osborne was this really amazing tactician and strategist, and he often fed the lines into David Cameron. And he thought he'd be really good at doing Prime Minister's Questions, but said he was absolutely terrible at it. And he kind of accepted that he just didn't have what Cameron had. And he would sort of like kind of say, look, I'm the guy that everybody booed at the Olympics and things like that. So it's kind of knowing if you have it or not. But the tragedy is when politicians clearly don't have it and they think they have it, it's really bad.
One of the things is journalists, Tom, we always sort of use this test. Is this someone you want to go down the pub with? As a test of, you know, that connection. And, you know, it gets polled all the time. In fact, there was a poll this week. It was to coincide with the British Kebab Awards. But it asked the question, who would you rather go for a kebab with and who would you trust to make the kebab?
two very, very different questions.
Two very, very different questions. And more people wanted to go for a kebab with Boris Johnson than Keir Starmer. But more people trusted Keir Starmer to make the kebab. And on the one hand, and this is the sort of thing that, you know, we'll get, if I discuss this on the radio, we'll get messages from people saying, what a load of nonsense, why aren't you focusing on the issues? But actually, in a single question, you get to, politics is a people business, and you get to the character of someone. And at the moment, maybe going for a kebab is more what people are looking for. But over the next 2, 3, 4 years, Boris Johnson's got to prove he can make the kebab.
I think the right measure of chili and garlic sauce.
Yeah, but with a real shortage of meat. After we've all slaughtered our own pigs. But this sort of thing, I think it's very easy. Someone could look at this event, Tom, and say, you know, personality politics, why are you even talking about that? Why aren't you talking about the Northern Ireland Protocol? Why aren't you talking about levelling up or reforming the NHS or social care, whatever, but because this thing matters, and actually the personality of the two characters will have a massive part in the next election.
Well, absolutely, and they had a massive part in Northern Ireland. Just take that issue. You know, Boris Johnson made a political decision, as we are now seeing, that he just needed to cut that off, end the sort of the bleeding as he saw it, you know, in Westminster, get through the election, and then I'll sort it out. Theresa May would never have done that. She was kind of she sort of was weighed down by this sense of duty that I can't do that. No prime minister could ever put a border in the Irish Sea. I can't do that. And she gets crushed by Boris Johnson. So the personality matters enormously. And I think coming back to Peter's point about persona, you know, I think what's fascinating about Boris Johnson is he's the guy that you want to go for a pint with, you know, or go for a kebab with. But he doesn't go for a pint. He doesn't go to the pub. He's not that guy.
Aisha?
I think also the question of how big your personality still is quite gendered in British politics as well. I think it's really, really difficult, A, for a woman to get to the top of politics, particularly in the Labour Party. I'll own that myself before anyone jumps in on that. But, you know, it's, I think, like, women who get to the top of politics are not afforded, well, very few politicians are afforded the leeway that Boris Johnson has. He is quite a unique figure from that point of view. But, you know, I think women who are in senior positions do find it quite hard. They find it quite hard to kind of judge how, because if a female leader kind of rocked up looking really messy or, you know, was a bit slapstick or said something offensive, you know, yeah, she would not last. That's an important thing to sort of factor in as well, which, again, does show you we do have quite a long way to go in terms of big politics being anywhere near gender equal. Like you mentioned, Jess Phillips, she's probably the only female politician I know with that really, really big, big personality. And while that people love her for it, as you said, Matt, she's also been penalised for it. When she went to be leader of the Labour Party, people were like, well, you can't take her seriously because she's got too big a personality.
Well, Angela Rayner.
Angela Rayner, yeah.
Gets massive grief for saying things. Actually, if Boris Johnson had said the equivalent thing, yeah. I would have gone, ha, isn't he brilliant? Yeah. Marvellous. Oh, he's so funny.
Nobody's ever perfectly behaved, are they? I mean, you know, I have to confess, when me and my friends sort of used to run through the fields of wheat, the farmers weren't too pleased about that.
I've been up all night super gluing the backdrop.
In short, it is time to put up or shut up. Turn it over.
What more can I do? We're talking personality politics. Some politicians have it, some don't. And some have even tried to teach it themselves. I spoke to Michael Cockle, the BBC documentary maker, a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about how Howard Wilson had basically taught himself how to have a personality by watching JFK press conferences. And then, you know, all that stuff of smoking a pipe on TV, but smoking expensive cigars in private. Well, at the Personality Politics event here at the Times and the Sunday Times Channel Literature Festival, I asked Peter Cardwell, former special advisor, of course, whether Keir Starmer could be taught how to have a personality.
I mean, I think the problem with Keir Starmer, I think he does have a personality, it's just not a very interesting one. And I think that the more he tries to tell his story, and, you know, how many times have we heard his backstory?
You know, he's got a mum and a dad.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if I hear the donkey story one more time, I mean, maybe it's just not that interesting. And I think that you can't fake it. You can't teach it. And I think you shouldn't have to either. I think we should have a range of politicians. I think we should have politicians who have big personalities, little personalities. I think we should have people from all walks of life in politics. And I think the slight problem is that you've got to the genuine bits of a politician are what's going to make them win, what's going to make people respond to them, and to put that across in the best way you can is the way forward. Because you can't, you know, there's no point in Keir Starmer doing a bungee jump. There's no point in Keir Starmer trying to be something he's not.
Well, as we saw yesterday, there's no point in Keir Starmer trying to reverse an HGV lorry.
Well, he failed his test. Yeah, that's right. And I mean, somewhat ironically, his worst HGV-related headlines than Boris Johnson, which is quite an achievement given the crisis at the moment.
Could you, Aisha, teach Keir Starmer to... I mean, it's an interesting... And I think this whole business of, you know, you need the backstory and you need to talk about how your dad had hands and all that thing. Boris Johnson has never done a speech going into his full family arrangements, partly because it would go on for even longer than Keir Starmer's.
And the child support agency
does all that matter? Because actually, you worked for Ed Miliband. And actually, I wonder whether actually the thing about Ed Miliband is a bit odd. That is fair, isn't it? I know he was your former boss. And I wonder whether voters who take a passing interest in politics, they looked at David Cameron and thought, he's a posh twit, but I've come across a posh twit before. This guy who likes baseball and Rubik's Cubes, who grew up in these like North London left wing, nobody's come across anyone like that before. And do you think people just tell that? And no amount of trying to make Keir Starmer or Ed Miliband seem more normal will work, because they're not normal.
Well, I think the thing that they both have in common is that they're the leader of the Labour Party. And I think you do have to factor in that being leader of the Labour Party, particularly in opposition, is literally the worst job in British politics. Actually, it's the second worst job in British politics. The worst job is being leader of the Labour Party in Scotland. That is actually like the worst job ever. So I think whenever you take over, you have got a lot stacked against you. From the minute Ed... Yes, I mean, there's no question Ed looks a little bit funny, looks a bit like, you know, there was a Wallace and Gromit kind of thing. But he wasn't some kind of, like, monster. But from the day he was elected, there was a narrative that was already set against him. You know, it was Red Ed. He was, like, some kind of terrible communist, even though all his policies have been introduced by a Conservative government now. You know, his brother, the story about his brother, all this sort of stuff. So I think when you're, like, leader of the Labour Party, you already start with a natural disadvantage. So it was interesting when Keir Starmer was elected, having followed Jeremy Corbyn, you know, that is really, really difficult if you want, like, the Labour Party being in a weird position. But so many people I was speaking to in the Labour Party when they were making their decision was like, this guy looks the part. He doesn't look weird like Ed Miliband. He's not wearing a donkey jacket like Jeremy Corbyn. He looks the part. He's a sir. He's white. He's male. He's had this... he's got a lovely wife. He's the most normal man you could get from the Labour Party. And yet, everyone's like, oh, God, he's a bit weird now, isn't he?
I mean, it's also interesting. It was seen as like a good counter to the Boris Johnson. You know, you've got Boris Johnson, some wild character, and he's the sort of yin and yang, and actually it's a good counterpoint. He was going to prosecute him at the dispatch box. And like, what do you fight a populist with?
So I think he needs to double... I mean, he's never going to out-funny Boris Johnson, right? He's never going to sort of match him in the charisma stakes. He's never going to be hosting Have I Got News For You. That's not his thing. And he shouldn't try to do that. I mean, my advice to him, and, you know, I would say this to him, I know him a bit... The thing that's really interesting, I think, about him is his actual work backstory, not his parents' backstory, not all the stuff with the llamas or the donkeys or whatever it is. It makes him sound like Dr. Doolittle. I think his really strong suit is he's done a really serious job before this job. You know, he was like this country's top prosecutor. You do not just get that job by being some kind of idiot. You know, you have... He's got a fine mind. He's obviously got a very ruthless streak to him. So if I were his team, instead of trying to kind of bring out all of this, hey, here's what I do on a Saturday, here's me playing football, here's me trying to be a normal person, he's not a normal person. He's the chief prosecutor in the country. They should actually lean into that a little bit more. They should sort of make that his character thing rather than I'm going to try and... You know, here's my Piers Morgan moment. Here's the bit where we're all crying about the past. Like, nobody wants to see you crying. We want to see you, like, going after the bad guys like you did in your last job. That's what we want to see you do.
One question I wonder is whether... Are we wrong even to be having this conversation? Is there something weirdly British about the fact that the guy on the zip wire, the guy who hid in the fridge, the guy from Have I Got News For You, you know, the Dulux dog of British politics is the Prime Minister, and by focusing on that rather than policy, is it the media's fault? Is it the political conversation's fault? Is it voters' fault? Should we just sort of, as a country, should we be more serious about this stuff, Peter?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think we have had a number of Prime Ministers, certainly even in my lifetime, who've had very, very different personalities, very, very different approaches, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. And I think that... You know, we can't blame the media because they give us what we want. You can't, the electoral system elects all sorts of weird and wonderful people to Parliament for all sorts of different reasons. I mean, I remember when Boris Johnson was in the absolute wilderness after he resigned as Foreign Secretary, and Tom was absolutely right to say that, you know, things change very, very, very rapidly. I remember asking a colleague of mine at one of the ministries I worked in how Boris Johnson was getting on, and I said, you know, are you close to Boris? Are you this minister? I said, you know, do you keep in touch with him? And he said, well, he borrowed my razor this morning, so yes, we do keep in touch because he'd popped round to his house to shave, which was a sort of slightly weird thing. But he was absolutely in the wilderness and then came back partly because of his personality, partly because of his approach, and partly because people wanted something that was completely different to Theresa May. So I think Aisha's absolutely right and Tom's absolutely right in terms of Keir Starmer. He needs to kind of own the serious thing, own the competence and own the courage in terms of a lot of the work he did as Director of Public Prosecutions. Especially, I mean, the most interesting part of his speech, for example, at Labour Party conference, I thought, was the stuff in regard to Stephen Lawrence and other cases that he had prosecuted. That's the interesting bit. And I think he needs to lean into that and own that and not try to be something he's not, because the big personality, this is what I do at the weekend stuff, that's not really his. It's part of him, yes, but that's not the dominant characteristic, and that's kind of what he needs to do. But I think we need, in this country, there's a brilliant book by Isabel Hardman called Why We Get the Wrong Politicians, and its central thesis is essentially, if we keep bashing politicians, saying they're all out for themselves, money-grabbing, you know, power-hungry people. And some of them are. Some of them are. There's no doubt about that. I've seen it up close. But most of them aren't. And I think we need to be a bit more respectful of people, anybody, for any party who stands for election. And then we'll get the right people in those situations. And then we'll get people of even an even greater diverse range of backgrounds and, indeed, personalities who will run for office and, indeed, high office.
Picking up on the point you made, I do think... I don't want to be sort of po-faced about it, but I do sometimes think we do have to, you know, that phrase, we get the politicians we we deserve. Of course, no one wants to be all kind of po-faced. And I wasn't one of these people saying, oh, Boris Johnson shouldn't have made any jokes in his speech. It's great to make jokes. Humour is a very powerful political tool. It's a powerful way of communicating with people. But I think it is incumbent on all of us, whether we're the public or particularly us as politicians, to not just get sucked into the sort of personality trap. I do remember a journalist after the 2015 general election saying, you know, I don't think we did give adequate, like we literally scrutinised the Labour plans to absolute death. I don't know if we did the same level of scrutiny on the Conservative things. So I do think that there is a point where you do have to look at all of the other things as well. But that doesn't mean politics has to be completely boring. Of course you have to have a personality, you do need to have humour. But sometimes I do worry that sometimes our politics, like you do brilliant thing on Prime Minister's Questions, PMQs Unpacked, there's just never any substance anymore. Like PMQs used to be a time where, yes, there'd be a lot of bluster, there'd be a lot of, you know, argy-bargy, there'd be some jokes, really good jokes, but you would often get something out of a session at PMQs. You just don't get anything anymore. And I think that is making our politics weaker.
I think it might be that we're just getting old, Aisha. No, it's not as good as the one in the good old days. In the event we did earlier, or the old PMQs, it was exactly the very first question, the first televised PMQs, was Tim Yeo doing a toadying. Wouldn't you agree with me that
we are all marvellous?
Yeah, it's what about, although I wonder whether social media plays a part of this as well, Tom.
Yeah, but I think what's interesting about Britain is we probably haven't had a mainstream politician who's been really good on social media in the way that Donald Trump sort of used it to take himself to the presidency. I mean, I think the one politician who has used it very, very powerfully was Nigel Farage, who obviously has a personality. You know, I think there is a legitimate question, would Brexit have happened without Farage's ability to use social media? I mean, he went to European Parliament and used it as a stage to be able to get videos of himself and put it onto Facebook and to Twitter. Without that, I think nobody would have ever seen those speeches. And I think we're yet to see someone. Boris Johnson actually is pretty useless on Twitter and YouTube. So what happens when somebody comes along and uses that? And I think on personality, I still think it is probably the most important thing in politics and when you're judging a character rather than their policies. Because you're electing them for 5 years. You don't know what crisis is going to come. You don't know how they're going to respond to a certain situation. And I think their flaws and their instincts just come to the fore in those moments. So you see somebody like Blair is willing to take gambles. Did we know that early on? Brown is just will not take a gamble, so just misses opportunities, which he, you know, could have changed his premiership entirely. I became fascinated with when I was researching an earlier profile of Boris Johnson, and it was about leaders are just much more likely to have lost a parent early in their life than normal people. So they've got this psychological blow in their childhood. So I think these things are buried very deep in all of us.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.